Thank you. And now, Pastor Comparé.
Something new came up to my attention, at least, hardly more than a week ago, that surprised me considerably. It has to do with one of the ancient countries, and yet it's startlingly modern because it shows one of the Bible's prophecies working out now, which I believe none of us had expected until at least into the time of the last great war. I want to talk to you about Egypt and about something that's happening there now that came about unexpectedly, and it shows that God can figure things out well ahead of us. We might as well get a little review on ancient Egypt. It's something that is hard to pin down exact dates on. The only, you might say, authentic history of Egypt was that written by an Egyptian priest about 250 B.C. named Manetho. And the difficulty is, no copy of Manetho's history exists. All we have of it are the fragmentary quotes in the works of some of the Greek historians. And they don't all quote it alike. So you do have problems. The origin of Egypt is lost in prehistoric legend. Now, long before there was one country, Egypt, there were settlements there of some substantial civilization. But they were scattered, a number of independent cities. And apparently it was gathered together as one country by a king named Menes, who united it into the one nation of Egypt. And when Menes did that is something on which you can get quite a variety of dates. Now, some of the ancient historians give quotes, purportedly from Egyptian sources, of early dynasties going back over a period of some 36,500 B.C. The early kings of this dynasty, they say, were the gods. Now, that can be, of course, wholly fictitious, or it can have a partial basis in truth. Now, Odin, who was worshipped as a god by the Scandinavians and Germans when they were pagan before Christianity reached them, we know is a real living person in his day. He was a Scythian chieftain who led his people from Scythia up into Denmark. And as a matter of fact, he is found in the family tree of George Washington. So, he was such a remarkable leader that in time they deified him. Now, there can be some such background as that behind the Egyptian legends, but they're so lost in antiquity that we don't know whether it's a pure fiction evolved by the priests or whether they have simply very greatly exaggerated the dates. By sinking a shaft to a considerable depth, they have found Stone Age implements that can be reasonably reliably dated about 13,500 B.C. At that particular point, there is one of those huge statues that the Egyptian pharaohs like to put up in their own honor, and the soil has accumulated around the base of it to a depth of about 10 feet. That is, you have to dig down 10 feet to get to what was the original pavement around this statue. And judging by that rate of accumulation, where they found these remains of a late Stone Age culture would be about 13,500 B.C. However, you do not find any evidence, historical or archaeological or of any kind, of a gradual rise of civilization in Egypt. It arrives suddenly. In other words, the evidence would indicate that an already highly civilized people from somewhere else moved in and settled there, bringing their own civilization with them. Now, the Egyptian priests were their historians also. They kept the records, other than the king's official records of his reign, and they told some of the Greek historians who inquired about it that the Egyptians were survivors of the sinking of the lost continent of Atlantis and had made their way across North Africa and settled in Egypt. Well, it's altogether possible because we can't find any other place to say they came from here. The first dynasty, beginning with Menes, according to some of the king lists, began as early as 5948 B.C. Sir Flinders Petrie, one of the great authorities on Egyptology, gave a date of about 4777 B.C., and later that has been reduced to perhaps 3300 to 3000 B.C. Of course, among the self-admitted experts on the subject, there's a great tendency to believe that nothing could possibly be as old as the people who lived then say it was. Oh, lop off 1,000 years, seems to be their motto. So, we don't know. But you take the Great Pyramid, built in the time of the pharaoh Khufu, who was in the second dynasty, not the one established by Menes. Some authorities place his reign as about 3969 to 3908 B.C. Others try to make it as late as, 2700 B.C. The true date, probably, is between 3000 and 3300. Now, as you already know, I presume, the Egyptians, having started with a rather high type of monotheistic religion, became finally among the most debased of the pagans. They were animal worshippers. The sacred bull, Apis, was worshipped by them. Well, much on the order of the Hindus of today worshipping the cow as a god. And if you have seen pictures of the various pagan gods worshipped by the Egyptians, you note that while they had human figures, they would have the head of a bird or a jackal or something of that sort. Well, I guess a bird-brained god was sufficient for a bird-brained people. However, the earliest traces of Egyptian religion that can be found indicate monotheism of a rather high type. In fact, some of their hymns are surprisingly parallel to some of the psalms in the Bible, showing that they started out with a very much higher religion than they finished up with. We get these early things from the fact that when we have been able to dig up the mummy cases of some of the early kings, or have found in some of the pyramids where they were buried. The Great Pyramid of Cheops was never a tomb and has no writing in it like the others have. But for those that were used as tombs, there were very extensive carvings in the passageways. Their theory was that the soul of the dead had to pass through a rather rigid examination to see whether he came to a good end or a bad one in the hereafter. and they were afraid that he might forget some of his lines. So these were put in his tomb and the passageways near it so he could refresh his memory as to what he was to say when examined. And in these, which go way back, dating back to the Second Dynasty, is found this rather elevated type of religion that soon thereafter disappears. But the animal worship, many authorities say, was established by 4400 to 4300 B.C. A great deal of work has been done on Egyptian history by David Davidson, who got out what I consider the only really authoritative work on the Great Pyramid. We have an amateur today who is willing to admit he is the great authority on the pyramid, but comparing his work to Davidson, whom he scorns, I find Davidson's scientific work very much better. I think all of you know how the interior passages of the pyramid have been found to be prophetic. While indicating only in a vague general way, as a turn for the better or a turn for the worse, what the nature of the event will be, they do give very precise dates. And these have been found to correspond with the most important datings in the Bible. Now, it was simple enough for Davidson, taking the three most official surveys of the pyramid, to compute the dates represented by these different points in the pyramid. But the question was, when you had found that it gave a date of 1486 B.C., let us say, the question was, what actually happened in that particular year? So he had to unscramble ancient history. Now today, this is the year 1972 all over the world, but there was no corresponding system of dating among the ancients. In every country, the only dating system you had was that their records would show that something happened on the eighth day of the fifth month of the 22nd year of the reign of King so-and-so. And then when he died and another king succeeded him, why, you began with the first day of the first month of the first year of the reign of King somebody else. And of course, you had these different reigns of the different kings and the different nations, all starting at different times. Fortunately, you had two ways of tying them together. The records of Assyria, we'll say, would show that in a certain year of the reign of King so-and-so of Assyria, they were at war with Babylon. And the Babylonian records would show that that same war occurred in such a year of the reign of a certain Babylonian king. So you got the overlap of the two reigns established. Then, because of their superstition, practically all of them recorded eclipses, either of the sun or the moon. Now, as I presume you know, while eclipses occur every year, there may be a great many years between two successive eclipses visible at the same place. Astronomers can compute not only to the day, but to the hour when a total eclipse of the sun, we'll say, was visible in Babylon. And since the historical records will give you an approximate time, so you know you're not dealing with some other century, when that's recorded as being on the evening of the 11th day of the 5th month of the 22nd year of the reign of King so-and-so, you can pinpoint it exactly right down to the day by the eclipses. So Davidson worked all this out with astronomical mathematics to pinpoint the days of the eclipses and checking up on the overlap of the records of the different kings' reigns, and then the works of the main ancient historians, while they didn't always agree with each other on everything, he was able to work out a complete and pretty accurate scheme of datings of ancient history. Now, with that, he could tell you then whether a particular pyramid date was really significant or not, because he could tell you what happened on that particular date. Davidson's datings would indicate the Great Pyramid was built somewhere in the period between 3500 and 2700 BC. Now, there has been a legend, if you want to call it that. Nothing apparently is credited with being history unless it's written by some left-wing Jew at Harvard. The people who lived in the days when it actually happened and knew what they were writing about, well, that's legend, you understand. There has been a persistent legend that one of the men who directed the building of the Great Pyramid was the patriarch Enoch. Now, Enoch lived from 3382 to 3017 B.C. So that would be within the period when other indications show the Great Pyramid was built. Then, another thing on which there's the usual disagreement in dates, there was a people who came out of Arabia into Egypt and took over and ruled for a while, the Hyksos, the shepherd kings. Now, as I say, the Egyptian pagan priests were the historians, and they have nothing good to say about these shepherd kings because it seems that they closed down all the pagan temples and insisted on the worship of just one god, which hurt the pagan priest's revenue no end. So you don't get anything good said about them. They ruled for a time principally in the northern or lower Egypt, and eventually were driven out. Now, you get all sorts of dates from the so-called experts. Some of them say the shepherd kings were there as much as a trifle over 500 years. Others say only very slightly over 100. But the most accurate records that we can get would indicate that they were there about 350 years, from 1937 to 1587 B.C. Now, Joseph, one of the patriarchs of Israel, was sold into slavery in Egypt in 1729 B.C. And this, as you can see, was when the shepherd kings were ruling. Now, they weren't technically Israelites, but they were an Adamic people, closely related to the Israelites, and the favor with which Joseph was received and made first assistant to the Pharaoh, prime minister, is something that is understandable when it came within the reign of these shepherd kings, when it wouldn't have been understandable in the reign of the ordinary native Egyptian pharaohs. The pharaoh Thutmose III, who reigned from 1744 to 1690 B.C., was evidently the pharaoh who promoted Joseph to the position of prime minister. His records from his 21st to his 42nd year of his reign, inclusive, show constant warfare. But from the 43rd to the 49th years inclusive, there was no record of any military adventures. Now, this was that 7 years period of famine that the Bible records, which had been prophesied to him by Joseph, and he had his hands full keeping his people contented enough that they wouldn't throw him out. So the idea of running around elsewhere to make military conquests was out of the question. In 1698 B.C., his records show that he ordered extensive dredging of the Nile River at the first cataract. Now, the headwaters of the Nile come way back in Ethiopia and perhaps a little to the west of Ethiopia. There are three principal rivers which have their start in high snow-covered mountains. These finally join to form the Nile, and it flows from Ethiopia down through the Sudan, which in the ancient days they called Nubia, down through Egypt and into the Mediterranean Sea. The southerly border of Egypt itself, at modern Aswan, the first cataract of the Nile, that was quite an important point. Now, there's nothing but utterly barren desert, both to the east and the west of this narrow Nile Valley. The only place that invasion could come from the south would be along the Nile Valley, because there's simply nothing to eat and nothing to drink on either side of it. So the Egyptians, from early days, had put heavy fortifications at the first cataract of the Nile. It's spoken of in the Bible a time or two as the Tower of Syene, which was at the first cataract, Aswan. You still find carved in the rocks there the markings where the Egyptians kept records of how high the Nile River rose in flood time. When the extensive snow fields in these mountain ranges where the Nile began, when these snow fields were melted by the coming of spring, the river, which had gone down considerably before that, the river was raised to flood height by all this water coming through. And since the river was a matter of life or death to Egypt, they soon learned to keep a careful watch on it. In years when the water was low, it was important to let every drop through. So on those occasions, the old Egyptian records show, the kings would order extensive dredging so that the channels wouldn't be blocked and hold the water back where it could percolate out into the desert on either side. So you find the Egyptian records entirely corroborating what the Bible tells you about the 7 years of famine that Joseph had prophesied and told the Pharaoh to prepare for. Well, the shepherd kings were expelled, finally, in 1587 B.C. And the Bible tells you, Exodus 1, verse 8, "Now there rose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph." And that, as far as we can determine, was Ramesu II. The Egyptian form of the name is Ramesu, but you generally see it in the Grecianized form Ramesses, because, as I say, we've been getting this thing through Herodotus' story of what Manetho told him. It's my fervent hope that for the early Greek historians, there is some superheated sub-basement of hell, because it was one of the primary articles of faith of these Greek historians that you must never, never, under any circumstances, when you describe one of these ancient kings, use his correct name or anything near enough to it to be recognized. And there isn't a one of these Egyptian pharaohs that Herodotus talks about that he gives a name that bears the slightest resemblance to the man's Egyptian name, as we find from the Egyptian records. And it's caused no end of confusion in trying to work this out. Well, Ramesu was the pharaoh of the oppression, the one in whose court Moses lived. Now, Moses was born in 1566 B.C., and he was aged 80 at the date of the Exodus, 1486 B.C. Now, Ramesu II was dead at the time of the Exodus. You remember that Moses, while he lived the life of an adopted member of the royal family of Egypt for a while, finally had to flee for his life way over into Midian in Babylonia until that pharaoh died. And the one who was on the throne at the time of the Exodus was Menephtah. The Egyptian records confirm 1486 B.C. as being the year of the Exodus of the Israelites out of Egypt. Well, from early times, you have a great kingdom and a great empire in Egypt. The first few dynasties, the Egyptians were a peaceable people who stayed at home, weren't trying to go out and conquer their neighbors. They really developed an amazingly high civilization for its day, higher than any of the other empires of their date. Later, they became like the other empires. They were governed by pharaohs whose vanity couldn't allow them to see any people anywhere that they didn't rule over. And so you had them, like the other empires, embroiled in perpetual wars of conquest or defending themselves against some other nation's wars of conquest. They, at various times, extended their empire as far as the Euphrates River. The city of Carchemish on the Euphrates River marked the eastern boundary of Egypt a good deal of the time. Now, during this period, at least the ruling class, and as far as we know, all of the Egyptians, were as white a people as any that you can find any trace of, either in early times or now. We think mostly of sculpture as being the great work of the Greeks. But as a matter of fact, the Greeks left us very few portrait sculptures. The Greek sculptures that we have were the artist's idea of what a handsome person should look like. Not any one person. In fact, it's well known that many of their principal statues were made with one person serving as a model for the head and somebody else for the chest and arms and somebody else for the rest of the figure and so on. And in fact, if you have seen pictures of many of the famous Greek sculptures, you will note that the face is a blank expression of total stupidity. They didn't indicate the pupil of the eye. So there's this blank, unseeing stare. Now, you find nothing corresponding to that among the Egyptians, and for a good reason. The Egyptians, starting with their monotheistic religion in the early days and carrying the idea down through their paganism, the Egyptians believed in resurrection. But there had to be something to resurrect. That's why they mummified the corpses of their people, at least those who could afford it, so that there would still remain a body. They didn't know how far in the future this day of resurrection would be. So they mummified it in the hopes they could keep the body still intact, ready to be resurrected. And they realized that the best of their mummification processes wouldn't last forever, and they didn't know how long it would have to be. So, with any Egyptian who was well-to-do enough to afford it, in his tomb there was a portrait sculpture of a man. It didn't have to be life-size, but it was a portrait sculpture of him, so that if the mummy disintegrated too badly, the soul could go into this statue and live there until the time came for resurrection. Now, there'd be no use in putting a statue of somebody else in the tomb. That wouldn't do you any good. So it was a portrait of the individual. And probably no time in antiquity ever produced such remarkably fine portrait sculptures as the early days in Egypt. If you met one of those people walking down the street after you had seen that portrait sculpture, you'd recognize him without any question. Now, they were such realists that they also painted these statues. And where it has remained sealed in the tomb until opened recently so that weather couldn't disintegrate the paint, why, the paint on it is still good. Now, they were so painstakingly accurate. The men, of course, would work out in the field, superintending their slaves working in the fields. So the men naturally got suntanned to a degree. So the statues of the men had a slightly darker suntanned complexion than the statues of the women, who spent their time mostly in the house, out of the hot Egyptian sunlight. Now, both the features, the narrow-bridged nose, the thin lips, the general cast of the face, show that you had a very definitely white race, as well as the complexion indicated by the painting of the statue. So all the days of Egypt's grandeur, Egypt was in Africa. But don't ever think of it as Negroid, because in that period of time, there was the death penalty for any free Negro found north of the first cataract of the Nile, that is, within the boundaries of Egypt. Now, they did have a trading post established just slightly within the boundary, and they would let Egyptians come there with their furs and that sort of thing to trade. But down really into Egypt proper, any Negro who wasn't a slave in chains was simply summarily killed on sight. So don't let anybody ever tell you that Egypt is an indication of a high Negroid civilization. There never was one. What today we call the Sudan, the area lying between Egypt and Ethiopia proper, in those days they called Nubia. Well, in the first place, of course, the Egyptian army repelled raids by the Nubian Negroes. Then, getting tired of that, they went down and conquered Nubia and took a lot of the Nubian Negroes as slaves. Now, you remember that Rome, in the days when her own people made up the Roman army, Rome conquered substantially all the then known world. And then, as they began degenerating, they didn't have the hardihood to serve in their army, so they began getting mercenary troops from the so-called barbarians, until the barbarians finally got tired of defending a people who had degenerated till they were no longer capable of defending themselves, and the barbarians began plundering Rome themselves. Well, the Egyptians began doing the same thing. They were becoming too civilized to serve in the Egyptian army. So, here were a lot of big husky Negroes down in Nubia. So they began training them for soldiers. Well, as long as you had enough Egyptian officers among them to keep control of them, that did serve a purpose. Remember that in those days you had no complicated weapons that required intelligence to use. All you had were bows and arrows and spears, and the Nubian natives at least knew what to do with a spear. Among all these ancient kingdoms, there was always a period of unrest and uncertainty when the reigning king died. Now, sometimes his eldest son was still fairly young, and any usurper who could get the support of a substantial part of the army might be able to move in and take over the throne. So, in Egypt, since that did happen on a few occasions, they developed the system that during the last years of the reign of any pharaoh, from the time that his oldest son grew old enough to be trained in taking the responsibility of the kingdom, you had a joint rule, a co-regency, so that for some years the army was accustomed to taking orders from the crown prince. And it wasn't a brand new idea when his father died and he succeeded to the throne and told them, you put down any uprisings. But back somewhere around 775 BC, when the reigning pharaoh died, the Egyptian governor of Nubia knew that as far as Egypt was concerned, there wasn't much of an army there. Down in Nubia, he had the best trained troops that there were. So he swiftly marched north into Egypt with his Nubian Negro army and took over. This was the 25th Egyptian dynasty. And for a period of about 75 or 80 years, you had these Nubian Negroes ruling Egypt. And, of course, that was the worst disaster possible, because you know what these Nubian Negro troops did with the Egyptian women. They were the military masters of the land. And in that period, Egypt became a mulatto nation. And that was the end of the greatness of Egypt. As the Bible said, they became the basest of all the kingdoms. And they have been ever since. Egyptian architecture, Egyptian art, everything declined badly. Well, remember, the northern kingdom of Israel, the ten-tribed kingdom, was conquered by Assyria between 740 and 721 BC. So you can see that this was during the period when this Nubian Negro dynasty was in control of Egypt. The power of Assyria back in the Tigris-Euphrates valleys, the power of Assyria had been rising during that period, and the Assyrians never did have much ability at anything except conquering their neighbors. They were quite a good parallel to the Turks in later times. They were a military people, perhaps even more so than the Romans. And they conquered their neighbors and looted them and made slaves of many of them. So, here you have this problem. Every little kingdom, if it only covered 200 or 300 square miles, had the idea it wanted to be an empire and conquer some smaller neighboring kingdom that only covered 120 square miles. So, every kingdom was in constant peril of attack by its neighbors. Not only the northern kingdom of Israel, but the southern kingdom of Judah were constantly in peril of efforts of the kingdom of Syria to the north and northeast to conquer them. Now, whenever they retained their loyalty to Yahweh God, they had no trouble with attacks by their neighbors. Most of the time they lived in peace, because when they were attacked, they inflicted such crushing defeats upon these other kingdoms that they weren't in a hurry to come back and make another attack. But when they lapsed into idolatry, as you remember they did about once every generation, then they were subject to attacks by the Edomites on the southeast and by the Syrians on the north and northeast. Well, under